What do you see when you take a look at global economic trends, or looking down the line a bit?
So if you look back 2 or 3 years ago, some of the trends I talked about were premised on shifting markets, right, from west to east. That actually has continued and, if not, accelerated. As you look at the prominence of the markets in Asia Pacific, the amount of liquidity they have, the amount of funding that they have, et cetera. The second thing that's happened, particularly over the last 2 to 3 years, is actually the silo aspect or fragmented aspect of around economies, meaning some economies in one part of the world are not going well, where others are going very well. So there's this concept of the question of capitalism and globalism versus nationalism and populism is definitely becoming a rising issue for the world to deal with. And it's not just a U.S. issue, right? You get that out of the U.K. with Brexit, et cetera. And what's the third piece I would say is that the combination of politics and economics become a heck of a lot more blurred these days. And that problem with politics is that the uncertainty coming from it has a dependency and an implication to the economies, the strength, the willingness to invest, et cetera. So those things have accelerated and converged quite a bit more than ever before.
When you put out your annual study of CEOs, what are they saying? How optimistic are they right now, given the current political climate? I mean, you know, I am certainly no expert on the economy, but it seems like the economy is actually doing pretty well right now. So does that mean companies are doing more hiring, or are they a little bit more concerned about where things could be headed and they're kind of holding back a little bit?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I would say the CEO community globally, and then I'm going to come back to the U.S., is probably net positive, including the amount of investment they're willing to do and the amount of hiring that they're willing to do. Now, the question on the table is, who are they hiring and what skill sets are they hiring? So that's definitely changing, particularly as you look at the types of the skill sets that they're looking for. Previously, a lot more technology enablement to those skill sets. And as a result, you're seeing maybe less people with specific retail consumer expertise or healthcare expertise or engineering expertise, but those with expertise in those areas coupled with a technology spin, or those explicitly with a technology spin, that actually is being gotten more weight as you look over the time. Second thing I would say is about the U.S. particularly. The confidence of the U.S. CEOs continues quite a bit. Any CEO looks for certainty. And the more they can get certainty on, or the potential for eventual certainty on certain issues, that's a good thing from their eyes, because they know how to invest. They know where to place their bets in terms of their portfolio, et cetera. So there clearly probably was, over the last couple of years, a moving momentum because of the strength of the economy. Customer savings, consumer confidence was driving that. Clearly, up until the election and after the election, there was this promise and hope for less regulation, more certainty on tax, and a better tax structure. So that confidence went up a lot more so. Now, lately, because of now the politics coming in, there's a little bit less of that. Having said that, the resiliency of corporates has actually increased quite a bit. So they've actually done a really good job of right-sizing their business, going after a different portfolio or mix of businesses, and the ability to deliver top-line and bottom-line results is pretty strong. And again, it comes back to, irrespective of the politics, the customer confidence, willingness to spend is out there, and they see that in a really positive way right now.
When you take a look at business and you kind of get away from the politics of it, a lot of companies around the nation, around the world, but specifically in the United States, a lot of companies have had to adapt the way that they recruit young talent over the years because the workforce has changed. As you mentioned, technology has changed so much. You talk with a lot of business leaders. You also talk with a lot of students. Starting on the business side, what do companies have to do to adapt to a workforce that has changed quite a bit in the last decade or so? I mean, the workforce is getting younger. Technology is being used more now than ever. So how have businesses been able to keep up?
So I think businesses have been able to keep up because they have brought a tremendous amount of new talent in, and they let that new talent actually drive the changes that they need to make. Second thing that's happened is they're doing a lot more alliances with other partners. So if you sit down and talk to a CEO of a technology company, they have many alliances with many of what I'll call the old historical corporates. And the combination of those two working together are changing the way the old corporates are actually doing their business. That, therefore, has changed then the way they actually go get talent and the way they look at their customers, and using technology to do both. So we're using data and analytics to think about how to do a search for a particular group of people. We're using data and analytics and artificial intelligence to pre-select the the kind of people I might be interested in. You're using visualization techniques and a lot of other telecommunication techniques to do virtual interviewing without actually face-to-face interviewing. So all of those techniques are being built in to improve the effectiveness and efficiency. But there's a lot more focus on not only the person and the resume, but also what's that person and resume actually doing in the digital world that they want to see more of. So there's an equal point in terms of the amount of information that the company's looking for. But the thing I would tell students and others to think about is think about your digital exhaust. What are you putting out there that now what organizations have an ability to see? So it's an interesting phenomenon to watch on both sides.
And knowing what you know as the head of a company and those techniques that you utilize, when you do talk with students as they prepare to take that next step and go out into the world, you're looking for certain things in people who are trying to get jobs with companies like PwC or other companies. So when you talk to students, what advice are you giving them to sort of prepare themselves for that first, maybe that first job application?
Yeah, so I think for a student getting prepared to work in the workforce or getting ready to enter that workforce, first thing you want to do is you want to demonstrate that you actually can problem solve no matter what types of problems have come your way. And that's important because whatever job you walk into today at a corporate or a small enterprise is going to change 2 to 3 years from now. So the ability to demonstrate you can be agile and resistant and resilient to the changes that will be coming your way is a really important soft skill, as opposed to just the technical acumen or the business acumen that we're actually looking for. So to me, as you look in this fast-paced world where businesses are changing radically, there's competitive threats, economic implications, et cetera, don't walk in assuming you're going to have a linear career path, and definitely demonstrate the skills that will demonstrate that you can go from job to job to job, even within one corporate, and you can still be successful. So adaptability, agility, and resiliency are key skills. How do you demonstrate that? It's not what's on the resume, but it's the stories of what you did to get the resume you have. So actually describing when you took on a project or led a person or a group of people or did a piece of work that demonstrated that agility and you moved from place to place and were successful, that's the kind of stuff that people are looking for in the interview process or in your digital exhaust as you go through the resume. Example.
Should students be confident that there are jobs out there for them? I think the stock market paints a very rosy picture. I'm not sure it's irrational exuberance or it is actually well-founded. But if you asked the body politic, if you asked the voters, if you asked some of our students, I'm not sure that they would show that confidence in the economy. They don't rate the economy the same way we do. How are you rating the economy? Should they be confident that there are jobs out there for them?
There's plenty of jobs out there for them. I would say the challenge is making sure that they are demonstrate they have the skills for those jobs. And that's the problem today in terms of the mixed match between skill set and job opportunities, because two things have happened. One is the skill sets that young people are coming with are different than the old historical skill sets. And second, the jobs are definitely changing. So making sure you can demonstrate how those matches work very well, there is a huge demand. And the biggest thing that the CEOs, you mentioned the CEO survey, the big issue that they have on the table right now that's rising in importance is not having the necessary skill sets to achieve their vision. So matching that is really important. But the question is, you've got to demonstrate you've got the relevant skill sets. You can change. You can be agile. You can learn and continue to learn along the way. Those core or soft skills are really important, Deborah, in terms of how do you make sure you get a job? And then how do you make sure you're successful in a career as you look ahead?
Okay.
So Deborah Stanley, president of SUNY Oswego, in a sense, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, you're also the head of a company. Your business is education. Your job is to prepare these students and give them the skills that they need to go out and to that next step, to gain those skills that Bob was talking about. But much at the same time, much in the way that the corporate world has changed, I think that the academic world has gone through a lot of changes as well. I mean, there are classes that are offered today that nobody would have heard of 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And so you also have to adapt and react to these changes in, I guess, so to speak, your workforce, the 8,000 plus students on this campus. You almost have to go through a reinvention. I mean, not just SUNY Oswego, but colleges and universities all over the nation almost have to reinvent themselves every certain number of years because of those changes that Bob was talking about. How are you able to make those adjustments? You almost kind of have to see into the future a little bit to know what's coming. But what are some of the things that you're working on now to sort of prepare those students to gain those skills that Bob was talking about?
Well, we definitely are one of our hallmarks as an institution, of course, is applied learning and experiential learning. And we actually use our alumni a great deal and people like Bob to mine those experiences for us to tell us which ones are the ones that are most effective for our students. And I can tell you I'm going to be rolling in solutions and problem solving to some of our experiences now. Reinvention, you know, the academy writ large is not built for fast change. It is, as a matter of fact, built to turn the ship around slowly so that the traditions and historical understandings about learning can remain the same. So it's somewhat challenging. That is a huge challenge in today's day and age. So we work with faculty who come in. Of course, our faculty turn over all the time. They bring new ideas. They bring ideas from Research One institutions, and they feed into. It is a collective environment. We want a greater voice on campus. So as we listen to students, and we learned a great deal about that this morning from talking with Bob about asking them a little bit more about how they learn and why they learn and what motivates them. But also as we ask our faculty to become connected to external environments, to actually help us be an anchor institution in our regions, and to roll in their research and their knowledge, they can help morph what programs look like, and we can give other credentials and competencies to our students in those ways. But learning is a two-way street as well, and it's becoming even more so in the traditions of higher education, where you will see teamwork in classrooms, you will see flipped classrooms where students are really controlling the environment within that classroom, and then taking it out to experiences that get them an opportunity to apply what they've learned in theory and then change what they know because the theory matches reality.
It's interesting. The disruption that's happening in the world today has blended individual sectors. Financial services has to think about retail, consumer, and technology. Automotive today with electric cars are bringing in technology and a lot more retail consumer type of approach. The same thing has to happen within the higher education system, where a linear or siloed approach to the kind of credentialing that's needed, and as a result, the curriculum that is going to be required, is now a heck of a lot more blurry. So if you think about a business school, the amount of business acumen one needs is very important. But in a technology-enabled business school, the amount of visualization, technology, and engineering necessary to create visualization of tools and techniques to run a business becomes so much more important. So I think you have to look at how do you create opportunities for people to apply the learning in a digital world? How do you make sure that they can apply it in reality where it's all now blending together? And the last piece, which we have talked about even this morning when I got together with Deborah and some of our faculty and deans, is how do we make sure that people understand the world we are walking into once you leave with a graduate or undergraduate degree in terms of how do you apply this in a day-to-day, including the environment that you're walking into?
It's a pretty good segue because as much of the workforce is changing in terms of technology and as the workforce is getting younger, the workforce is also getting a lot more diverse. The world is getting more diverse, it seems, every single year. One of the things that's part of my job is when I'm asked to do an interview like this, I have to do a lot of research about the person that I'm interviewing. And in doing that research, there are a couple of words or phrases that came up a lot in my research of you, Bob. And I keep seeing diversity. I keep seeing gender equity, words like that. And you've really taken this on and become a leader in this. I don't want to call it a cause. It's more of like a movement. It's more of a culture shift. At what point in your career, because you left SUNY Oswego and went to PwC, you've been your whole career at PwC. At what point in your career did you kind of stop and think, something has to change here? You know, what's happening in corporate America isn't working and something needs to change.
I would say it was probably in my somewhere between 8 and 10 years into the organization. And there were two things that happened then. At that point in my career, I was seeing a lot more around the world. That gave me a different perspective of things outside of the U.S. And second was after the time I was in Japan, I had an opportunity to be there for about 3.5-4 years. And in that case, I saw a world that was much different and less diverse than even a U.S., which arguably was not necessarily as diverse as it needed to be back then. So those two things became important. The second thing that happened was at that point in my career path, the responsibility to be a leader in an organization, regardless of title, was that you had to think about the business, the strategy, the vision, and what you're trying to achieve. We're a people business. A lot of people might think of us as a group of consultants or accountants or tax professionals. We are a people business. And as a result, we have to be thinking about having the best talent. If you're going to have the best talent, you better make sure you have the most diverse talent that's representative of what the world outside looks like. And second, that best talent, when diverse, brings lots of different perspectives. And therefore, you can get the best thinking, the best advice, and then the best actions that we can take to be successful and enhance our brand as PwC, but also help people develop and hopefully enhance their own personal brand as they think around their career paths going forward.
Why do you? There are still a lot of companies out there that are taking a long time to make these adjustments. A lot of companies are, a lot of men in boardrooms out there. In your opinion, how have companies done, if you take a look at corporate America, how have companies done in recent years in terms of increasing diversity, bringing more women into roles of power and executive roles in companies? Are companies kind of as a whole more gender equal now than they were, say, 10 years ago? Or is there still a lot of work that needs to be done?
There's a lot of work that needs to be done. The facts are that when you look at boardrooms, there hasn't been a significant enough change to get a call better parity from a gender perspective in the boardroom. And there's actions that are needed to deal with that. The reality is those studies that we've done, actually, there's a point of view that says a male in a boardroom actually doesn't value the diversity as much as a female in the boardroom. And therefore, when you think about new board members, diversity doesn't become high enough on the criteria for a selection of a new board member. So that's an important phenomenon that requires then the chair of that board, who might be most likely a male, and maybe even the CEO, to spend more time with a what I'll call predetermined course of action and a force that's going to counter the natural biases that might exist. So I use this word of how can you be intrusive? How can you be more proactive to get a different result? And the second thing I would say is that while we have great profile examples of where you have a Mary Barra at GM, or you had the potential for Hillary Clinton as the president of the United States, or today you've got Merkel and Theresa May and others like that around the world in leadership positions, there's not enough in what I'll call middle management and senior management that has fed the pipeline where there's enough parity going on right now. So I think there's a lot more work to be done, both on gender, but also let's not forget race and LGBT and other aspects of what inclusiveness really means.
What could be done at the academic level, do you think, to help move that along?
A great deal, and a great deal is being done, both on the national scene and at individual colleges and universities. It is a high-profile event for all colleges and universities. It's a little bit different because education, when we talk about education and access to higher education, we're talking about social justice. We're talking about equity in a slightly different way than economic equity only. We're talking about giving someone a threshold into a different life, not only for themselves, but for their families and for their future families as well, changing the culture moving forward. And it's a really important high value of the institution, of our institution, to do so. So if you've noticed, over the last 4 or 5 years, we have greatly diversified the student body. This year, the first-year student body coming in was 34.9% diverse. And that's something we're not only proud of, but we also feel that we're serving the need that's out there. And it's an organic change in New York State because the demographics are changing so much. And we recruit downstate because that is where the 18 to 22-year-old population is. And we move through that in a way that's very deliberate. We look at high schools. We actually do it with a heat map involved. We make sure that we have high schools where we know students are interested in the types of programs we have, that there are students who have come from those high schools who have been successful at SUNY Oswego. And then we make a move to recruit at those high schools. So we're building the pipeline as well as recruiting a class. It is a little bit more difficult if you are talking about hiring PhDs and doctoral or terminal degree individuals to teach at our institution. These individuals who are coming to us as students want to see someone who looks like them. They want that. They want to aspire to the kind of model that they can see in front of them. It's more difficult. We can find out in anywhere that we are hiring, and every year we hire probably 30 new faculty because of retirements and turnover and such. we can tell in those disciplines. We have the data to look and say who's graduating with a terminal degree in this area, how many are out there already, who's coming up in the pipeline. Higher education is now also determining to grow our own, and that is that we're mentoring individuals at our institutions to go through PhD and terminal degree programs so that they can come back and teach. It might be one of their options. So as the numbers change, things will change for us, but it's not rapid enough in the professoriate.
When I think of diversity and gender equity, when you look at the world, there are a lot of countries that are still downright oppressive when it comes to women in the workplace. But who do you think, what countries are doing it right?
So it's interesting to define right, because when you look at some of the Nordic countries, they've actually put laws in place that require similar or what I'll call parity within the boardroom. And that has actually forced a change. And they've gotten that change as a result of it. If you were to look at some Asian countries, believe it or not, in the policies that were determined 50, 75 years ago, both the policy drove a family orientation where the family supported women more so being in the workplace. And as a result, you have a number of senior women as the head of the Federal Reserve equivalent in Indonesia, Philippines, other places like that, or very presidents that are there. So it's interesting to say what's right, because I think you got to decipher the details. And one of my major issues is that when people talk about diversity and inclusiveness, it's too easy to keep it at a general high level. You've really got to get very specific, because even in the Nordics where you've got representation, pay equity is not as good as it needs to be. So we've got a separate issue. Even though we've got representation and equality in the boardroom or perhaps in senior positions, the pay is not necessarily the same. Whereas in other countries, where in fact in the U.S. and the U.K., there's actually a lot more better pay equity than a lot of other countries that have more senior women. So you've really got to go deep on some of these issues to decipher what exactly is the issue we're trying to go after. And it's too easy to say diversity and inclusiveness is a one-size-fits-all.
You said a little earlier that it's there's still some work that needs to be done to increase diversity and increase gender equity in corporate America. A question for both of you, I guess. What do you think it's going to take? Do you think it would take something like legislation to increase diversity in boardrooms and increase that pay equity? Or do you think it's just we have to wait for the culture to shift?
I don't think you can afford to wait.
You can't afford to wait for legislation these days.
That too.
I mean, you could do it by executive order, but then it would change with the next administration
right.
that came in.
Yeah, the reality is we as a business community or we as those in higher education cannot afford to be demonstrably different than the society we are part of. And as a result, we are going to have to move faster. Otherwise, the trust between society and business or the trust between society and the education systems is going to continue to deteriorate. And that's a bad thing for everybody involved. And we see some examples of that today, where that fairness and sense of opportunity is available to all. So I would tell you that the system is ill-equipped to wait. And as a result, you are going to need both business to operate differently and have a higher degree of expectations, which starts at the top of the house in the boardroom. And second, you're going to have to probably move in terms of some legislation, which is not going to make people happy. And I would tell you, when I first came into my roles, I was not a big believer in more regulation in this area. I thought the human aspect, the heart, mind, and soul would overcome these. The reality is it's not going to make it fast enough. So I do think you have to move in some of those directions.
Well, as we wrap up here, I'd ask you, the both of you, to kind of pull out your crystal balls and take a look 5, 10, 15 years into the future. And what do you both think that next movement is going to be? Will it still be gender equity? Will it be the gender pay gap? Another issue, what is on your radars right now as you look into the future?
So from my perspective, I would say there's two big issues, and I'm going to pivot off of the diversity and inclusiveness issue right now. First is the implications of technology. And let me tie it back to gender for just one moment. If we don't have more women that have the STEM skills that are necessary to actually be successful, and I do believe that the business skills of the future will have technology embedded in them, then we also are disadvantaging women. So we have to be thoughtful about that. But this concept of technology, data, and the implications in all that we do is a really big trend that has both business and social implications that's going to be important. The second big trend is the divisiveness that's happened, and you see this in the political world today, and that's a phenomenon not only happening around the U.S., but it's also happening around the world. And we can't be so naive to that, because what has served us well in the past for economic growth and social growth has actually served well in the past, but it stops there. It's not necessarily set for the future. So we have to redefine what success looks like. And success looking ahead is both economic and social responsibility in terms of the individuals of bringing more along for the ride. And that's going to be a very important factor for our leaders, our business leaders, our community leaders, our academics and the like, to be much more thoughtful about that future world because of the trends that have gotten us to where we are today. And they're not going to exist tomorrow.
From an academic standpoint, I mean, it almost seems as though in the next 5-10 years, you might have to go through another reinvention. So what are you thinking of right now?
Absolutely. The technological overlay to education is going to be huge. As we talk about artificial intelligence coming on, as we think about virtual reality worlds and how teaching might be impacted by virtual reality, which I think is going to go through a massive revolution. So how we do what we do and how we credential what we do is going to change dramatically, probably not 5 years from now, but in 15 years, it won't look the same at all. We talked about this earlier. I think that colleges and university campuses will still be differentiators because there will still be a collection of individuals who come to grow and learn together. Whether they learn in the same classroom environments that they do today, or very different space or different ways, they will still need, I hope, the connection to each other to learn in teams and to advance in teams as well. But I also think that as we look into the world, the human factor to me is my second concern. The human factor, because as we talk about jobs and connecting students to jobs and experiential learning and such, as we move into other environments and the world of work changes dramatically, and the world of productivity and gross national product and all of that changes dramatically, the huge shifts in the world, seismic shifts in the world, and geopolitics also plays a big role in that. I worry about the human factors of understanding each other. When you talk about, I shouldn't bring this up, fake news, but and not at WRVO, certainly
here.
Never here. You have a brand that people trust, mm-hmm. and that's a wonderful thing. But I do think there's fragmentation. I do think there's cynicism and distrust everywhere. And that is going to separate us from reality, not from news, but from reality. We won't know what to believe. Yeah. We won't know which way to go. I think those are going to be things that are really going to impact education as well.
Well, thank you very much. This has been fantastic. I appreciate you both coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.